I would like to introduce now the first speaker on today's program, Dr. Roberta Ballstead Miller. Is a staff associate on the Social Science Research Council of the Center for Coordination of Research on Social Indicators in Washington, D.C. She received a Ph.D. in history from the University of Minnesota in 1973 and achieved special recognition through the Putnam D. MacMillan Fellowship, a graduate school special grant, and the Alice E. Smith Fellowship. Before joining the staff of the Social Science Research Council, Dr. Miller was a research associate of the American Institute of Architects Research Corporation in Washington, D.C. We welcome her back to the university today to talk about urban growth and regional development from her national perspective. Dr. Miller.
Thank you, Greg. My purpose today is to discuss the shape of human settlements in the future, both to anticipate what cities will be like in the year 2000, and also to determine what kind of planning mechanisms we will have to implement or to put into effect in order to bridge the gap between the cities of today and the cities of the future. I will do this first by looking at historical and contemporary patterns of change in the cities, trying to find out what made the cities the way they are today, what kinds of processes are going on in the cities today, and secondly, by looking at what should be happening over the next 25 years in order, again, to improve the quality of life in the cities for the 21st century. There's no end to the predictions that are now being made about what the configuration of the city will be in 25 years or more. Most urban prophecy, however, is based either on the continuation of current trends in urban development, which in most cases would be a continued expansion of the cities and a continued expansion of the suburbs out into larger and larger megalopolises beyond the first beltway, beyond a second, perhaps even a third beltway, or else predictions about the future of the city have to do with technological innovation which would create a science fiction world confined only by the limits of one's imagination. One of the advantages of predicting some sort of new science fiction world in the future is that you don't have to worry about city councils approving budgets or voters approving bond issues or these sorts of things. But life is rarely that simple, and change in the cities is not going to happen by itself, whether by extension of current trends or some miraculous intervention of a science fiction world. Instead, the cities which we have today, which are subject to exceedingly complex social and economic influences, will continue to change in ways that might be predictable today and might be controlled today if we implement the proper kinds of planning mechanisms. It is important that the kinds of changes that are going on in cities today be recognized and be acknowledged, and that policies which affect the cities also are acknowledged and are used in order to direct change in particular ways. For one characteristic of American urban policy over the past 30 years is that urban policy has been unacknowledged. Officially, the federal government does not have an urban policy. In actuality, however, most, if not all, federal activities have important ramifications for the development of the cities, for the development of social life in the cities or the economic life of the cities. The official laissez-faire, or hands-off attitude, which the federal government has adopted toward the cities, ignores the very important interdependence between the local economy and the national economy. And we're finding out today that there is also a very strong interdependence between the local urban economy and an international economy. This came out very recently when the ambassador from West Germany approached President Ford and said that if the city of New York goes bankrupt, it would have ramifications for the economy of West Germany. So the American cities are not isolated. Their problems are not limited to the cities themselves, but they have national and international ramifications. How do we plan for future urban development? Well, as I indicated before, we look at patterns of growth and development which are taking place today and then try to structure a series of planning mechanisms. First, we look at how cities got to where they are. Very briefly, the cities that we have inherited in 1975 are the result of federal and local policies which have been in effect over the past 30 years. The period after World War II was characterized by rapid, low-density, horizontal urban expansion. Residential construction, which had virtually halted during the Depression, had picked up somewhat at the end of the 1930s, was again halted when World War II started. After the war, building resumed at a frantic pace. The economy was expanding. Returning GIs were marrying, were having families, were moving into their own homes, and the pent-up demand for housing, which had been building up over the past decade and a half, exploded. In this respect, interestingly enough, Peter Drucker has recently written that it is not the number of new families which are formed that is most highly correlated with the demand for single-family detached dwelling, but rather it is the number of second children born in families that is highly correlated with the demand for single-family detached dwellings or suburban housing. And in the post-war years, many families were having second children and third children and fourth children, and the detached single-family dwellings which were being built were spreading out from the city into new formerly agricultural areas. The urban growth which took place in the post-war period differed from earlier periods of urban expansion in a very significant way. Rather than repeating the dense settlement patterns in near or new but contiguous urban areas, post-war settlements leapfrogged over empty spaces next to the cities and filled up empty but cheaper land far from the cities. These were the suburbs that were located at some distance from the city boundaries. The new suburban settlements were built where land was cheap, so the housing could be built cheaply, and the housing could be built at very low densities. So these homes had very large yards, and there were very few homes per acre. This created a suburban checkerboard of developed and undeveloped land, which is only now being filled in. Thus, we had created an automobile city, some call it spread city, or urban sprawl, for the post-war suburban settlement patterns required the constant use of an automobile. Suburban shopping centers with enormous parking lots sprawled across land which was formerly used for agriculture. Somewhat later, other shopping facilities, which again were accessible only by automobile, grew up around the intersections and the entrances and exits to freeways and beltways. The automobile-based pattern of living was supported and encouraged by federal and local policies. Again, I repeat, there was no deliberate policy at the federal level or at the local level to subsidize suburban expansion. Yet uncoordinated housing policy, transportation policy, zoning policies, and tax policies all work together effectively to encourage suburbanization and to subsidize it. What were these policies? First of all, the federal government, through the Federal Housing Agency, the FHA, guaranteed loans for the construction of single-family dwellings. These new single-family dwellings, of course, could be built most easily, most cheaply in the suburbs. The FHA deliberately stayed away from inner-city homes. They deliberately stayed away from homes in the decaying gray areas of the city. They would not guarantee loans in these areas. Thereby, they made these homes poor economic investments. They made it unfeasible for people to attempt to rehabilitate these homes or to spend a lot of money on their upkeep because there wasn't a market, because the FHA would not guarantee their loans. And therefore, the FHA hastened the deterioration of the inner city areas. A second subsidy for new homeowners was provided by federal tax deductions for mortgage insurance and property taxes. Federal and state governments also built superhighways from the city centers to far-flung suburban settlements. These enabled the suburban resident to live far from the city and yet quickly drive to and from his place of work. Soon, industry and office buildings began to build near the superhighways because the land there was cheaper, the taxes were less. And in the process, they weakened the employment basis, they weakened the tax basis of the cities. Suburban zoning policies kept the poor out of the suburbs because they could not afford homes that met local suburban zoning requirements. The poorer portion of the urban population was thus forced to remain in the cities. They had no choice. They could not move out to new homes in the suburbs. They were segregated, in a sense, from the suburban middle class. In this way, suburban residents escaped paying for social services for this part of the population, and the cities, which were unable to zone out the poor, became responsible for providing social services for them, and this was an increasingly large portion of their population. I should add here that there's nothing intrinsically wrong with the low-density pattern of settlement, which is characteristic of post-war suburban settlements. If at all possible, people should always have the option of whatever residential pattern they wish. And many, of course, will choose low-density housing. The problem with the post-war suburban expansion, however, was that not everyone had this choice. This choice was only open to part of the population, the wealthier part of the population. Low-density suburban housing, although subsidized by the federal government, was available only to the middle classes. So in a sense, it was a transfer payment from the government to the middle classes, a form of welfare, which the poor did not benefit from. The expansion of urban settlement into these restricted areas, because they were a separate political jurisdiction, was also largely responsible for the decline of the urban economies in the post-war period. And finally, a way of life in the suburbs, which was supported by the federal government and thus by all taxpayers, and which was available to only part of the population, was far more costly to the entire population in terms of energy and air pollution than the more densely settled residential patterns in the cities. For with hindsight and the pressures of an incipient energy crisis today, we can see the costs of the low-density settlement patterns which grew up in the suburbs in the post-war period. For example, investment costs are higher for low-density settlement patterns than for high-density settlement patterns. Operating and maintenance costs are higher for low-density settlement than for high-density settlement. Air pollution due to automobiles and residential heating, the major sources of air pollution, is greater per housing unit in low-density settlement than in high-density settlement. The cost to the community of water pollution through storm runoff and sediment accumulation is greater in low than in high-density residential areas. Heating and air conditioning requirements are greater in low-density areas than they are in high-density areas, and suburban residents must travel farther to jobs than urban residents. Moreover, public mass transit is not economical at low densities. The reason for poor bus services in the suburbs is very clear. It doesn't pay. The automobile is far cheaper. The fact that it uses up the limited amount of fossil fuels that we have left, the fact that it pollutes the air, is incidental. It's not economical. In short, in nearly every way, suburban low-density settlement patterns are costlier to society and more detrimental to the quality of life in metropolitan areas than the high-density urban settlement patterns which they replaced. As the suburbs were expanding, the city itself became an economic backwater in this period. New retail and industrial facilities went to the suburbs, where land was cheaper and plentiful, where taxes were lower than in the cities. As we have seen, many middle-class families also moved to the suburbs during this period, for very good economical reasons. Left behind in the cities were the poor, the blacks, and elderly whites, groups which were frequently dependent on welfare, and welfare which had to be supported by a declining tax base in these cities. As demands for social services in the cities rose, taxes increased. As taxes increased, more industries and more families moved to the suburbs. This circular process, the flow of capital and people from the cities to the suburbs, is called urban disinvestment. And the combination of urban disinvestment with the rising demand for social services in the urban populations results in the precarious economic situation which most cities find themselves in today. This is what has happened in New York City. Although in New York City, the situation has been exacerbated by the fact that they have a much higher dependent welfare population than most other cities. And they have a much higher level of social services in New York than other cities. And combined with that, the continuation of a fiscal crisis over several mayoral administrations over a number of years has resulted in a certain amount of fiscal mismanagement to meet the budget at the end of each year, exacerbating the situation. But New York, as you all know, is very close to bankruptcy. And at this point, it still is unknown as to what will happen. If New York goes bankrupt, all American cities will suffer, as well as the national and international economies. Other cities will not be able to raise money from private sources. No one is going to buy municipal bonds, because they realize that if the federal government allows New York to go bankrupt, there is nothing to keep other cities from going bankrupt as well. And already, Municipal bonds are tax-free. The profits from municipal bonds is tax-free in order to induce people to spend money on the cities, to put their money into municipal bonds. And yet that still is not providing enough of an inducement to attract money into the cities. In other words, the situation is very precarious. The decline of the cities and the growth of the suburbs in the post-war years is a very familiar story, and I'm sure you've all heard all or parts of it before. Yet my purpose in going over it once more is twofold. First, I wanted to show how unarticulated and perhaps even unconscious urban policy at both the federal and the local level were instrumental in creating the urban situation which we have today. And I also wanted to show how the unplanned and uncoordinated post-war expansion was costly in terms of energy and environmental pollution, and how it was destructive in terms of the urban economy. What is the relationship between cities and their suburbs today? Political power in most metropolitan areas is fragmented into many separate political jurisdictions. Metropolitan settlements, the metropolitan areas of cities, encompass hundreds of individual political units. In the case of New York, there are thousands of individual political units in the New York metropolitan area. Most of the governments are suburban, comfortable if not rich, and understandably reluctant to assume the economic problems of the central cities. Another impediment to effective metropolitan cooperation is the competition for economic development capital which takes place between the many governments of the metropolitan areas. Particularly today, when investment capital is in short supply all over the world, all governments, from the smallest suburbs to the major central cities, want to attract new investment to improve their tax base and their employment potential. The suburbs, of course, the suburbs have an advantage in this contest. They have cheaper land, they have a more favorable tax structure, and better access to highways for long-distance transport. And this is particularly important because the truck has become the major vehicle for long-distance transportation in this country. In short, the fragmentation of power in metropolitan areas is beneficial to all except the central cities. This fragmentation of the metropolitan areas has been enhanced in recent years by a new federal policy which was ostensibly promulgated to aid the central cities. The program through which this was accomplished is one that you're all familiar with. It's called revenue sharing. The idea behind revenue sharing is logical enough. It is to make the most efficient and effective use of federal funds. The way that the architects of revenue sharing plan to do this was to discontinue all categorical grants given by the federal government. Now, the categorical grants are those grants which are for specific purposes. A city which receives a categorical grant must spend it in the way that the federal government decrees. Model cities is one of the largest of the federal categorical grant programs. With revenue sharing, however, the federal grants to cities were to consist of unrestricted transfers of funds from the federal to the local governments, block grants with no strings attached, arguing, rightly, that only local governments know the nature of local requirements. The supporters of revenue sharing also argued that the federal categorical grant programs imposed inappropriate spending patterns on local governments. Unfortunately, however, in refusing to set spending policies for local governments and in turning federal money over to local governments to spend as they please, the federal government is inadvertently setting urban policy again. For the effect of revenue sharing is to strengthen and encourage the balkanization of the metropolitan area by funding and supporting all local governments, not just the cities with the biggest problems. In fact, the cities with the major urban problems are now getting less money under revenue sharing than they got under the federal categorical grants. Smaller governments, small towns, suburbs, county governments are all getting more money from the federal government than they ever got before. However, this is not where our urban problem is. The urban problem is in the major central cities, and these cities are getting less and less each year. If urban growth over the past 30 years has been haphazard and undirected, if federal and local policies have unwittingly caused the low-density horizontal expansion characteristic of the automobile suburb, and a federal revenue sharing policy even now is encouraging the perpetuation of a multiplicity of political jurisdictions within a single metropolitan area, then what should be happening to make the cities better places by the year 2000? One, we need a federal urban policy. Two, we need effective regional planning mechanisms. Three, we need public stimulation of the urban marketplace. Four, we need new means of financing social services. And five, we may even need a new kind of federalism. Let's look at these in order. The first is federal urban policy. As I have said before, we have no such policy before. We have no such policy today. Although we have had a cabinet-level Department of Housing and Urban Development since the middle of the 1960s, urban development in HUD has always taken second place to housing policy. And housing in the federal government is tied to the banking interests. For example, HUD-sponsored urban legislation, which goes to Congress, if it goes to the House of Representatives, it goes to the House Committee on Banking and Currency. There's no committee on urban affairs, just a subcommittee. And if it goes to the Senate, it goes to the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. Urban policy, such as it is, has low priority compared with the interests of the banking and the housing interests. The immensity of the problem facing the cities today requires a strong urban policy, not necessarily a policy which will take powers from the cities or the metropolitan areas and give them to the federal government. I'm not asking for the federal government to do more. But I am saying that the federal government needs to recognize its responsibility and the effects of its actions on local urban economies and on metropolitan areas. And it must realize that responsibility for the future of the cities lies in all three levels of government: the federal, the state, and the local governments. Most importantly, federal urban policy should be a policy which recognizes federal responsibilities and this influence of federal government on the cities. Specifically, a federal urban policy should consist of a population policy and an economic policy, so that it could use the federal funds it spends outside of revenue sharing to stimulate economic growth, to stimulate population migration in the areas in which it concedes it would be in the best national interest to stimulate growth. In other words, the federal government has to look at all parts of the nation, all regions, all metropolitan areas, and figure out what is best for the national economy and what is best for these urban economies, and try to coordinate its efforts in all these areas instead of letting things happen on a haphazard basis, and letting one hand do one thing and another hand do the other thing, and sometimes find that they're working at cross purposes. We also need an agency to look at the long-range social and economic implications for urban areas of all federal policies and legislation. This agency could be located in HUD, but it would probably be better located in Congress, where it could function as an urban equivalent to the Congressional Budget Office now being set up by Alice Rivlin, the economist. We need more information about the effects of federal actions on the local level, and an agency such as this, whose sole responsibility is to attempt to assess the long-range effects of federal policies, could furnish that information. It needs to be institutionalized, however, either in the executive or the legislative branch of the government. In addition to federal urban policy, we also need better regional planning capabilities if we are to improve our cities by the year 2000. With the gradual population infill of the suburbs, metropolitan settlement patterns have made the old political boundaries meaningless. The de facto city today is the metropolitan area, not the central city. But because it has inherited the now artificial jurisdictional boundaries of cities and suburbs, the metropolitan area is at war with itself. The competition between governments in the metropolitan area is wasteful, it's inefficient. Metropolitan government itself, where there's one government for the entire metropolitan area, is far more efficient than the divisive balkanization which now exists. Unfortunately, the history of metropolitan government since World War II is a very disappointing one. In all, 36 major metropolitan reorganizations have been presented to voters. Of these, 10 have been accepted and approved. All of these were in the South. Outside the South, it is virtually impossible to obtain voter approval of metropolitan government reorganization. This is despite a major federal attempt to encourage metropolitanism in the 1960s. The Housing and Urban Development Act of 1965 provided that organizations of public officials could get money from the federal government in order to undertake metropolitan planning. The 1965 Act required that these councils of government, as most of them came to be called, should consist primarily of elected officials from the various municipalities that make up the metropolitan area. Most metropolitan areas today have councils of government, but they remain voluntary associations of local governments, useful in planning and training, but without any decision-making powers, and in short, without any teeth that could make them effective. Because of the failures of locally initiated and federally sponsored attempts to establish metropolitan governments, future reorganization may have to be initiated by the state governments. And certainly it was the state government which initiated the most advanced and to this point the most successful metropolitan government in the nation. And that is, of course, the Twin Cities Metropolitan Council. The Metropolitan Council, as you perhaps all know, was established by the state legislature in 1967 as a governmental unit for the seven counties which constitute the Twin Cities metropolitan area. It was envisioned as a unit of government which would stand one step above the local government and one step below the state government. It is made up of 14 members appointed by the government from the legislative districts in the seven county area, plus a chairman who is also appointed by the governor. Although council members serve only on a part-time basis, there is a full-time staff with responsibility for specific problem areas, such as solid waste, sewers, air quality, open space and recreation, health, housing and the aging, transit, highways and airports. In addition to these groups, there is a section of the council which is devoted to long-range planning. This was charged with producing a development framework for the entire metropolitan area. The preparation of the framework was an important part of the work of the Metropolitan Council, and it took from 1967 to 1975 for the development framework to be completed. As you all may know, it was adopted in March of this year. The plan provides an alternative to the urban sprawl which has been taking place over the 30-year period. It advocates that shopping, educational, business, and recreational facilities be located in selected sub-regional areas, all within a 15-mile radius of the Twin Cities metropolitan area. And it was hoped that the formation of these areas would attract housing, concentrated high-density housing, to these sub-regional centers as well, so that the areas in between the population and shopping centers could be kept open for recreational purposes, for conservation purposes, and in general for open space. In order to encourage settlement within the urban services area, planners in the Metropolitan Council plan to withhold services such as sewers, transit, and roads from areas which they wish to remain unsettled. In other words, this was the stick that they were going to hold over the communities, over the local governments, in enforcing their long-range plan, the development framework. In addition, once the development framework was adopted, the planning committee could act as a regional A95 review committee, which would review all development projects which utilized federal funds. The development framework was far-sighted, and it promised an attractive alternative to uncontrolled urban sprawl. The very success of the Metropolitan Council, however, during the 8 years in which the development framework was being written, militated against the implementation of these planning concepts, however. For during the period when the development framework was being worked out, other sections of the Metropolitan Council were working at their more narrowly defined tasks. Under the council's aegis, a significant amount of subsidized housing had been built throughout the seven county area. The bus system had been expanded to over 1,025 miles. Sewer lines had been run under land which was scheduled to remain open and unsettled to 1990 or even beyond. This made it possible for any township to tap into these sewer lines and build housing in an area which the planners and the people who worked on the development framework wished to remain unsettled. And finally, a network of highways and roads made almost every part of the seven county area accessible. In short, the very services which the long-range planning section of the council hoped to use to control settlement patterns were extended to many, if not most, parts of the metropolitan area by 1975. A second limitation on the council's ability to implement its development framework is its political status. Although it is viewed as an agency between the local and the state governments, it works with local governments only in an advisory capacity. Its political power is dependent upon its coordinating and administrative work, its power to make recommendations to the federal government through the A95 review process, and its ability to win public acceptance of its plan. In other words, it depends upon the goodwill of the participants. Although it is viewed as an agency between the local and the state governments, it works with local governments only in an advisory capacity. Its political power is dependent upon its coordinating and administrative work, its power to make recommendations to the federal government through the A95 review process, and its ability to win public acceptance of its plan. In other words, it depends upon the goodwill of the participating political units. Thus, the Metropolitan Council will probably not be able to achieve all of its objectives in terms of long-range planning for the metropolitan area. However, in terms of coordinating urban services and economic development for a large number of municipalities, the Metropolitan Council remains a model for the nation in terms of metropolitan government. In future years, metropolitan government will have to be expanded. Just as American cities outgrew their 19th and early 20th century boundaries after World War II, so the contemporary metropolitan area will outgrow its present boundaries in the future. This will be a different kind of growth, however, than we've seen before. The new expansion of the metropolitan area will probably not consist of the same pattern of population growth as we have experienced in the past 30 years. For until transportation innovations are available, which use less of the increasingly scarce fossil fuels, the line of urban settlement will probably not extend much farther out than it is now. New urban construction in the next decades will probably take place within the confines of the present metropolitan area. Suburban areas will be settled more densely. Even urban areas will experience a great deal of infill in vacant areas. Rather than an extension of the urban population into rural areas, then, the new metropolitan boundaries of the future will represent an extension of the urban area's sphere of interest into the surrounding region. For as fossil fuels decline and energy costs and demands increase, other sources of power located in reservations or on energy parks become essential to metropolitan areas. For economy and safety, these energy parks should not be located in or very close to the urbanized areas. But because of their social, economic, and political importance, cities will want to have their sources of energy within their political control. The only way to control energy, then, would be through an enlargement of the metropolitan political domain, although not necessarily an enlargement of the area of densely settled population. As the urbanized area makes demands of the surrounding rural areas in terms of energy supplies and perhaps food supplies, metropolitan-wide governments, of which the Twin Cities Metropolitan Council is an outstanding example, will be outdated. We will need regional governments. Where it exists, metropolitan government will give way to regional government, and those areas without metropolitan government will adopt regional governing mechanisms. So far, we've talked about the need for a federal urban policy and the need for metropolitan and regional planning mechanisms. A third area which must be dealt with to improve the state of the cities by the end of the century is the broad area of economic development and capital investment in cities. Strictly speaking, this is not an urban problem. It is a national problem due to a nationwide and an international shortage of investment capital, but it has important ramifications for cities. The creation of backwater economies in the central cities between 1945 and 1975 was due as much to the negative effect of municipal conditions and policies as it was to the positive pull of suburban economies and the changing composition of urban populations. Therefore, an understanding of the reasons for the decline of capital investment in these economies is essential for developing programs to reverse that trend, to reverse the urban disinvestment, which has been characteristic of urban economies since World War II. Among the factors which discouraged investment in the cities in recent decades were the high costs of land purchase and assembly, the increasingly restrictive effects of high taxes, complex building codes and unrealistic zoning, costly time-consuming procedures on the part of public officials, diminishing levels of public investment in both services and facilities, leading to the general deterioration of vast areas of the city, and discriminatory lending practices such as redlining and the practices of FHA, which further destroy the capacity of the city to renew itself. During these years, the declining urban economy represented a pocket of poverty surrounded by suburban plenty, and heavy federal expenditures pumped into these backwater economies generated very little by way of an economic multiplier. Simultaneously, the pressures on local governments, created by a stagnating economy and a rising demand for social services to the poor, resulted in rising property taxes, which slowed down the economic process. The result of these factors has been a relatively low level of economic activity in the cities outside the occasional central business districts, and an economy incapable of attracting or sustaining new investment. Yet the economic potential of the cities can be improved. It will take a coordinated federal and local urban policy which uses the resources of the federal government to stimulate economic investments in cities. It will also require some form of metropolitan government, such as the Twin Cities Metropolitan Council, to redistribute development equitably throughout the metropolitan area and to disarm the ruinous competition between metropolitan governments, or between local governments in the metropolitan area. Still, a third important ingredient in urban economic revitalization is the need for a systematic confluence of public, private, and community resources. The government cannot rebuild urban economies alone, and at this point in time, there is no reason to believe that the federal government wishes to do so. Certainly, that has been the experience of New York. The federal government will not come to the aid of the cities, or if it does, it will only come under a great deal of pressure, and as William Simon says, by also imposing some sort of punitive measures so that other cities realize that the government is not going to bail them out. Cities must attract private investment capital. To renew the economies of cities, more money must be invested in urban areas now than ever before by all levels of government and by the private sector. And to attract private investment capital to the cities, the public sector must structure incentives for private investment. It must make the cities an attractive market for private investment. Too often, the carrot which local governments have held out to developers, to private investors, has been tax abatement, and that is relief from paying property taxes for a certain period of time. This makes development rather attractive, but it has an adverse effect upon the city's economy. For what happens is that with the new developer paying no taxes, the pressure for tax revenue increases on other residents of the city, particularly on property owners. And again, it encourages the urban disinvestment that I've been talking about. A better and more effective incentive is the assumption by the government of a portion of the developer's front-end investment costs or initial investment costs. For example, throughout the years of the urban renewal program, many developers turned away from the cities after having their front-end investment tied up for months, their available capital that they have to put in their projects initially, tied up by litigation and bureaucratic fumbling at both the federal and the local levels. However, if the government assumes a part or even all of the developer's front-end costs, the private developer then could move in, can attract additional private capital to this project, and that is what we want to get, is more private capital into the cities. And then this will start the urban economy moving in a more beneficial way. In addition to front-end costs, the city can also negotiate zoning and code flexibilities for specific development projects and can acquire land and buildings for new and adaptive uses by developers. I should emphasize that the importance of attracting private investment capital to urban development projects lies in the enormity of the effort required to renew the urban economies. The public sector will not and perhaps cannot do the job alone. It requires private investment capital, and the private sector must be actively involved. A fourth area requiring concerted planning in order to improve the state of the cities in the next quarter century is the domain of social services or welfare. Because the cities have become the repository of the poor, and their expenditures for social services are considerably higher than the surrounding suburbs, they need much more by way of tax revenue to support these social services. and in cities with a declining tax base, the burden of these expenditures become increasingly heavy over time. All cities today have declining tax bases. Part of it is due to general inflation. In a period of inflation, the tax base of the city declines because reassessments do not take place fast enough to raise the level of city revenues up to the level of the inflation. The burden of social services could be alleviated somewhat if we had effective metropolitan government in which social services for the poor were paid for by the entire metropolitan area. This would relieve the pressure on urban property owners somewhat. But this would not alleviate the basic problem with the way in which we allocate social services in this country. For the responsibilities for welfare and other social services is now determined by geography and artificial political boundaries. Most social services are the responsibility of the local government. The size of the population receiving these services is dependent upon many factors, none of which has to do with the local government itself. For example, the size of the population receiving welfare in a city may be due to factors which are taking place hundreds of miles away from the city. It may be some agricultural crisis which causes hundreds or thousands of people to migrate to the city, where, because they come from rural areas and lack urban employment skills, are unable to find jobs, and they go on welfare. The city is required to support these people, although the city really has nothing to do with the causes of their migration to the city or the reason that they are on welfare. In essence, poverty is not the problem of a particular geographical area, and welfare should not be supported by a particular geographical area. Poverty is a national problem. Social services should be provided on a national basis. This would be the most equitable way to distribute them. In a sense, it's also the most efficient way, because the federal government is far more efficient at collecting taxes than the local government or the state government. The federal government spends less to collect each tax dollar than the local government or the state government. Therefore, if the federal government expanded its revenue-sharing capabilities to include social services and made direct grants to all governments for social services, they could get more for the money which they collect much more cheaply than the cities could get for the money that they collect more expensively. And also, the burden of providing social services would be spread throughout the country. It wouldn't be focused on any one particular area. Again, to bring in the case of New York, this is part of the problem in New York City today. The city has one of the largest welfare populations in the nation. The population comes in large part from rural to urban migration. People have migrated to New York from the South. People have migrated to New York from Puerto Rico, come to the city and are unable to find jobs. They go on welfare. The reasons for their coming to New York are not the responsibility of New York City, and yet New York City has the responsibility for paying for their welfare. And now New York City, because of the high level of welfare, because of the high proportion of its budget which goes for welfare, is going bankrupt. The problems are national in scope. The payment should come from a national source. A final suggestion for the improvement of the cities by the year 2000 is that possibly new levels of government be created which are more reflective of the actual regional, metropolitan, and neighborhood divisions within cities and within urban areas. I've already referred to this in other contexts. Many of the problems facing cities today are the results of artificial and outmoded legal boundaries, boundaries which made sense when they reflected the actual distribution of the population. But because of the changing population distribution over, particularly over the past 30 years, have been outgrown and no longer make sense. The establishment of metropolitan forms of government which can assume political as well as administrative functions will reestablish better urban political boundaries. The further establishment of some kind of regional government, possibly on a multi-state basis, will also serve to create a form of government more representative of the social and economic structure operating today. In speaking about what has been happening in the cities for the past 30 years, about what will be happening in the next 25 as well, I've avoided saying what I think will happen to our cities by the year 2000. Or rather, I should say that I've saved it for the last, because crystal ball gazing is always fun. 25 years from now, what will cities be like? Certainly, they will be very different from what they are today. I don't know what form technological innovation will take, but there will be significant technological changes. We won't be in a science fiction world, that's for sure. But much of our society, as it is organized today, depends upon fossil fuels, particularly gasoline, which drives the automobiles and the trucks on which we depend for so much of our commerce and transportation. Because long-distance transportation will be expensive and wasteful of energy, I believe that the regional economy will emerge as much more important than the national economy in the next 25 years. Production of any good will not be centered in one geographical area as it can so often be today, but rather will be duplicated in each region on a smaller scale, and then will be distributed within that region. Regional transportation systems will be important rather than national transportation systems. Regional distribution systems for commerce will become very important, and regional energy systems will also be essential. The cities will play a smaller role in the production and distribution of goods and energy, but will play a larger role in the production and distribution of services, such as education and healthcare. The cities, which tended to be centers of industry and commerce in the 19th and early 20th centuries, are going to be centers of the expanding service sector, I think, in the next 25 years. We're going to have cities which are populated largely by people who are engaged in the professions, in the service areas of health and education. So we're going to have a different population in the cities. The decay of central business districts and the declining population densities in cities, which is already taking place, may be the first evidence also of the emergence of a new kind of metropolis. Rather than the traditional industrial city with a business and manufacturing center and a residential ring around this core, the future city may be polynucleated. That is, it may have many smaller business districts rather than one large business district. The present central business districts may simply be one of these nuclei. These business districts will probably grow up around existing shopping centers whose large parking lots will prove fortuitous because they will provide a lot of vacant land for new high-density settlement in terms of business facilities or in terms of residential facilities. Deteriorating inner city areas which cannot be rehabilitated may be turned into recreational areas. In other words, homes which cannot be inhabited, which cannot be rehabilitated or improved in any way, may simply be bulldozed and will have large parks and green spaces interspersed among residential and business areas in the cities. So the configuration of the existing cities will probably change too. But crystal ball gazing can be frightening as well. In order to experience a smooth and comfortable transition to a new way of life in cities, which are physically aging, and to do this in a time of energy shortages and supply shortages, in order to come out of the present urban crisis and the present economic crisis in the cities, with cities which are pleasant to live in and pleasant to work in, we have a lot of work ahead of us. We must have a responsible federal urban policy. We must have a workable regional planning system. We must attract private investment capital back to the cities. We must turn the backwater economies around and reverse the disinvestment syndrome. We must reestablish our social services on a national basis in order to relieve the urban economies of this burden. And finally, we must institute new levels of government which better reflect the distribution of urban populations in the last quarter of the 20th century. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Miller.